good to have you all with us today and on this lovely, breezy Tuesday that has become. We're going to talk about all manner of things in the course of these next 2 hours, and we have people coming in and out of the studio, almost at random, but not quite. No, they're actually here sitting. Anthony McCarthy, of course, is with us, our first live show of the week. Yesterday's show was about Columbus Day, and or as many people call it, Indian Holocaust Day instead of Columbus Day. So we had leaders from the American Indian communities from around the country on our air yesterday. Today, we are going to talk about what has been breaking in the news. Anthony McCarthy, who is host of the Anthony McCarthy Show, every Friday in this time slot, 5 to 7 p.m., is with us, as he always is. Anthony, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Mark. And we have a very good show, a very diverse show today.
Very diverse show today.
You know, it's hard to blame Columbus for the fact that people were here before him.
I think I blame what he did to the folks once he got here.
I was going
to
say, I think more anger about when he got here.
That was Bob Summerbee, who's editor of the Daily Howler and an op-ed contributor to the Baltimore Sun. Also a person who's not allowed to write in the Sun is with us, Dr. Richard Vatz.
That's right. All it took was a change of personnel. Man.
Joining us by phone is Dr. Lester Spence, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Lester, you there?
Hold it down.
Hey, Lester. So, Lester, have you had an op-ed printed in the Sun yet?
No, not yet.
Okay.
But I play ball with him. He's a real good guy.
Number here is 410-319-8888. You can log on to Facebook, the Mark Steiner page, either fan of Mark Steiner Show or the Mark Steiner Show page at the moment. We switch completely over to the fan of Mark Steiner Show and join the conversation there that we have begun on the issues that we're talking about today. The very first issue are talking about is what just happened in the United States Senate, where with the help of one Republican, the Senate Finance
Committee. That's bipartisan, isn't it? Richard?
She's a rhino, right?
Republican.
Republican in name only.
A rhino. Yeah. That's a new one on me. Do you know that one?
I had heard that before.
That's Olympia Snow. But I think that she's got a lot of character. I mean, she doesn't know how how the money is going to be accurately depicted as a $829 billion over a decade, but she still voted for it. She really swallowed all of her objections and voted for the bill. And I just think that we've got to do a little bit better on the integrity angle than that.
Who does?
Olympia Snow.
Well,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that what we can say that Olympia Snow did is she trusted her chairperson, who had been working and actually delaying legislation for months, trying to get Republicans to come on board. And finally he said, you know what, we can get this legislation passed, even if not one single Republican votes for it. I think she trusts him. I think she trusts the president. And I think she also trusts that the country needs health care legislation.
Whatever happened to trust but verify?
That went out with the man who said it.
we dropped the verify part. We edited.
Maybe we should have just a plebiscitory democracy and not have representatives at all. I mean, why Olympia Snow could just kind of read the public opinion polls and just vote how they indicate she should vote.
You know, I'll just say this about the vote today, and this is just the committee vote. There's
a long way to go.
I mean, the bill they end up voting on will not even be this bill, so this is just a preliminary step.
Right.
You know, we all get into the mode of we want the bill to pass or we want the bill to fail based on partisan feelings. That said, I must say, as I look at this bill, you know, the one part of the healthcare problem that I'm baffled and astonished by is the massive spending we do here. And I don't see much in this bill at all that has anything to do with reducing the gigantic extra spending that the American consumer does on health care. And every family in America pays for this. We're paying 2 to 3 times as much as other developed nations pay per person. I haven't seen a single newspaper make a serious attempt to explain where all that money goes. I don't see any indication in the Baucus bill there's any serious attempt to address that. That money is still going to keep going wherever it's going. And the average person is going to be paying it either through the employer or out of his own pocket. And I just don't see that. To me, is what's just not present in this
bill.
Let me
just add one point to Bob's statement, and that is that the psychiatric coverage, which used to be, it used to be that parity was opposed for years, and now a parity has been sneaked in, and they had parity last year for federal workers. Now they're going to have parity in the Baucus bill for everybody, and everything is
covered. Parity meaning what?
Parity meaning that every psychiatric illness, and there are over 300 of them, including things like adjustment disorder and social anxiety disease. In other words, anything you see a psychiatrist for can now be covered by national health insurance if this bill passes.
That's going to be a requirement
for
insurers?
Yes, parity. In other words, every psychiatric illness, every alleged psychiatric illness, of which there are over 300, and of which everybody in this room could qualify for several of them.
That's for sure.
That is all covered in the same way that somatic physical illness.
What about the professor? He's not in the room. Did you mean to include him in the...
let me bring Lester into this conversation. Let me read something that came on Facebook. Jerry writes in on Facebook, "Well, it looks like the Republicans did what they set out to do, and derail any real reform while the Dems allowed their plan to be gutted. The whole point was to provide an option that removed the ridiculous overhead costs of the for-profit companies and replace them with a lower cost of a publicly managed program. This does none of that. I wonder what exactly is gained here. Dems don't get any of the benefits to the public. The Republicans get a plan that they can point to as a terrible failure by their opponents. We all still lose." Lester Spence?
Yeah, I think that's right. And to be fair, I was teaching all day today, so this stuff is all news to me.
Okay.
So what I would say is that both parties were strongly influenced by lobbies. And I think what the Democrats can say is they passed a bill, and to that extent, President Obama can. I mean, if assuming this bill goes through and everything, even if it's changed form, can declare this a success. But the real question is whether this produces better health care at reduced cost to the consumer. Now, unlike your other two guests, I'm actually not that pressed. If we have reduced direct cost to the consumer but increased spending tax-wise, I'm actually not that pressed about it, because I think that I look at this as an investment. And if you look at this as straight up a cost outlay, yes, it's going to be a problem. If you look at this instead as an investment, that increases the ability of the American worker or the American citizen to be productive, then that's a winner. But it's only a winner if those direct costs that we spend out of our pockets decrease.
Mark, I think everyone is right in their belief about this legislation. I think that Richard is right. I think Bob raises the right questions about the cost. Where I disagree with everyone is, except for the Dr. Spence, is that if you are uninsured in America, this particular legislation, which will not look like this once it gets to conference and once we get a final bill, if you are uninsured in America, this gives you coverage. And we
this
have.
This bill does?
Yes.
No.
It not only does it give you coverage, but it actually makes it difficult, as Richard said, for the insurance companies to deny you.
It not only gives you coverage, it makes you buy it.
And it does require.
That's a very important point, yes.
But it's a very important point that conservatives were all in favor of during the campaign.
Yeah, but there are a million issues on here. And I actually didn't even know we were going to discuss this, but let me just raise one. I don't believe that there's been much. I haven't read the Bugs bill except for the psychiatric aspects of it, but I assume they have not made much headway in tort reform. So you're going to have the same defensive medicine that is practiced that is one of the major sources of the high cost of health care.
One of the things I said in the Facebook thing that I wrote out here, and I'll read it, what I wrote was that the Congressional Budget Office said that this bill, in its present form from the Finance Committee, it will take over 10 years to reduce the number of insurance and uninsured people by 29 million. It will still leave 25 million people uninsured after 10 years.
Yeah.
And a third of those are undocumented workers, undocumented people in this country.
Well, you know, there were from the beginning, there were two ideas that this health reform plan was built around. One is universal coverage, getting everyone insured. The second idea was lowering costs. Now, in the campaign, candidate Obama was literally using the figure $2,500 that your insurance premiums will cost $2,500 less under my plan. That would still leave us paying more than you would pay in France or, you know, in another developed nation proportionally. However, that was I just don't see where the savings to the consumer exist in this bill. Now, it's going to increase coverage as it exists, but the whole notion of reducing our astonishing costs seems to have pretty... Yeah. It's not even being discussed.
It's not part of any of these bills. What are you going to say, Lester?
So there's a political move where once the lobbyists exert their weight, all of a sudden people, the range of what becomes politically possible gets unfortunately truncated. And the first population of people that loses are just the regular citizens, no matter what their political party is. It's just really, really unfortunate.
But I think it's very careful for us not to use other developing countries as the standard. I mean, because when we hear people say what is available in France, what is available in other developing countries.
Developed,
you're right. we have so far to move this ball up the hill, this boulder up the hill with health insurance in this country that it's not fair to think about systems that have actually been in place and working for generations.
Well, it's good that people that today can't get insured. It's good that they will now be able to get insured. That's good. But that's only one half of what the original idea was. The other half was to get people insured and to lower these ridiculous costs that we have.
But the costs are not going to be lowered. And
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and everything is covered. I mean, this is again, I have not read the Baucus plan extensively, and I focus mostly on the psychiatric aspects of it. But this is an enormously lengthy, complicated and it's a bill which covers virtually everything and covers it at not just parity in mental illness, but parity for everything, where there are no limits to what you can charge. And I just think it's irresponsible not to allow the public to see this bill, for 3 days? I mean, this calls for an enormous amount of timely debate.
Maybe I would like to our listeners think at 410-319-8888 as we talk about the bill that went through the Senate committee, because this bill is going to be, has nothing to do with what finally comes out of the House and the Senate at all. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Talk to us about your own health insurance experience. It's interesting. I noted today in one of the papers or websites I read, I forget which one now, was that two of the Blue Dog Democrats, two of the women, who are Blue Dog Democrats from California, came over to away from the Blue Dog position because they said we have to have a public plan for this to work.
That's really great.
And I think this will be the battleground. When we talked to Congressman Sarbanes the other week, when Anthony and I talked to John Sarbanes, I pushed him on this idea about health care. I said, well, will you vote for the single payer bill for it when it comes to the floor? Not that it can win, but because A, in your past you've mentioned that you think it's a sane system, and B, because that might set up a battleground up saying you have to have a public plan and know that a X amount of Democrats are going to go, we demand this or we're not going to vote for it. So I mean, I think that's where the battle's going to be. The battle's going to be over the public plan, and I think that we'll see what splinters out from there. I mean, I'm talking within the Democrats, because the majority of Republicans are going to vote against any of the plans that come up, but that this will be a Democratic battle is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if you pass a bill with Democrats and Olympia Snow, I just think you're going to have a polarized America like you've never seen before.
We already have it.
We already have it.
Well, but I mean, look, you know, at one hand, the Democrats could say, well, that's too damn bad. But I think there will be a tremendous political penalty for the Democrats to pay, and so on one hand, that's a salutary effect. But
what are you going to say, Lester?
If the Democrats have to pay a penalty in a context in which Republicans have, on the one hand, argued according to their principles, but on the second time, violated their principles in attacking the president's plan, then maybe America's a lot poorer off than I thought it was.
Under this plan, the penalty can't be more than $1,900 a year. I'm just kidding.
You're terrible.
What do you all think about the fact that anytime I mention polls, I feel like I'm being hypocritical because I've attacked them so much. But what do you think about the polls that report that a hefty majority of people who currently have insurance are happy with their plans? 70%.
Well, I'll tell you what my first reaction to that is. Whenever I see that poll, there's no question. That's what people tell. My reaction is they don't know why they shouldn't be happy with their plans. They don't know that their plans are massively overpriced, that they're paying massively more than the foreign experience suggests makes any sense. And people don't know that. That's, I mean, you ask the question, so I'll answer it. That is my reaction whenever I see those polls. Now, they may be happy. It's because they don't know they're being ripped off, if you don't mind my using pungent language.
But do you think...
As someone who actually conducts studies public opinion and conducts polls for a living, I would say I need to see the question wording, and I need to see the other questions that were with the survey. I mean, it's like a factoid.
And I also believe that when people have insurance, and we have talked about this in public forums, they are afraid of these costs that Bob keep bringing up. If we find a way to cover everybody, they're very happy with their coverage, they're very happy with their plan, but they're afraid of how that explodes if we find a plan where everyone has an option
and
a choice. And they're right, yeah. But I think that drives why they are very comfortable with their plan, and they really don't want to be educated or have a further conversation about uninsured.
I have to say also in most of the polling, and this is, you know, I'm a little surprised by this, but it seems to be showing up in all different kinds of questions. People are, by fairly large numbers, supporting the idea of a Medicare-like public option. Now, I assume they don't really know what that means, but it seems that even when the question is asked just like that, a public option like Medicare, people are in the 60% supporting it.
That's because people work on broad metaphors, and they have heard somewhere...
No, I agree.
Yeah, they've heard somewhere that Medicare works, even though they don't know the current financial status of Medicare.
Let's hear listeners thinking, 410-319-8888. Are you satisfied with your health insurance? What do you think about where the health care bill and debate is now in the United States, in the Capitol, where you think it should go? And it's interesting to me that the polls really smack up against each other. One poll says... If you look at Rasmussen today, then only 44% of Americans support President Obama's health care plan. But then there's another poll to say people don't even know what the health care plan is because they're confused about it. And a third says that 56% of Americans want a public plan. And so these things are all kind of banging up against one another in terms of what they really mean. 410-319-8888. Pam in Owings Mills, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, Pam.
Thank you all for taking my call. To answer your question, I have a question, and to answer your question about my health care in particular, to answer that question, no, I'm not happy with it at all. I would like to be able to choose what I want, not be forced to take what my company has planned for me to take. To answer that question. Mm-hmm. And I have a question is, I understand that this health plan is not where it should be, because I prefer to, you know, maybe look into something in the single payer type range. And I'm not sure, but I think this is where you guys are heading, but I'm not sure. But why is it that we can't be this? Why is it that we're not looking at maybe some of the positive things about this? Because if you realize, we've been having this conversation since 1990 or whatever it was, when Clinton tried to get health care going and couldn't get it done then. Now we're getting to the point where we're having some sort of health care. Does it benefit everybody as much as possible? It can. I know it'll benefit me because I have a pre-existing condition. So if I lose my job, and I don't think a lot of people understand, if I lose my job, what do I have? So in some ways, it'll help me. So I guess my question is, there are some positive things from it. Is it everything that we would want it to be? Can you elaborate on some of the positive things that people might be able to look at?
Let me just say one thing.
This is Richard Vetch.
I actually think that there are a couple points on which liberals and conservatives agree. Not a lot, but a couple points. One is the desire for portability, that people ought to have the right to be able to move and maintain their insurance. And I think there's very little. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think there's very little disagreement on that. I also think that there is general belief that there should be catastrophic coverage for people. That if on a pre-existing ailment, that if you have tried to get, that you're not just trying to get insurance once you get the ailment, but you've tried for a long period of time, and you've been unable. I think there is general consensus that you ought to be able to get coverage for a pre-existing ailment, and there ought to be something to take care of portability.
Does that satisfy you, gentlemen?
Well, I'm very curious about former presidential candidate, former Senator Bob Dole, Republican nominee for president, was very clear in a recent speech that he believes that the Republicans in the long run are on the wrong side of this, that the Baucus bill, and particularly this idea of a public option, are so significant to the American people that the Republicans are not offering any intelligent option or alternative, that ultimately, Republicans are going to suffer on this because the American people need this. The reason he theorized that Republicans are so strident in their opposition to every point in this legislation is because they need to damage Obama, and that his popularity, although it has shrunk to about 56-57%, that Barack Obama has to be damaged. So anything that gives him any credibility with the American people, they are going to oppose. And he said ultimately it's going to hurt the party.
Very quick, so I want to get to
I think you can find people who believe that. I mean, I don't speak for anybody but myself, but I mean, I have no desire to see Barack Obama suffer and therefore health insurance would suffer. I mean, mm-hmm. I think Barack Obama is a very, very impressive man, but not an impressive politician. I think he's way over his head, and I think he's going to fail in foreign policy, he's going to fail in domestic policy, but I don't get any thrill out of that. I mean, I'd like to see some things taken care of by a health care bill, but I don't want to see parity coverage in psychiatry. I don't want to see a public option.
I have 300 pre-existing conditions, according to Richard. I can get covered
for everything.
Before we turn to Les, let me go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on the healthcare debate, your own experiences with the healthcare system, we'd love to hear as well. Dolores in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Mark Steiner. You probably don't remember me. I'm Dolores Foster.
Oh, I do.
And you probably remember my father, Dennis Foster.
I do. How is he doing?
He's deceased now.
I didn't hear that. I'm so sorry.
Okay, and I heard about your father, and I found out about that after the fact.
Right.
But the reason I'm calling, since you're discussing the new health care bill that Congress might possibly pass, this is what my experience was. I had insurance. I had a prescription coverage. I had heart problems. In order to address my heart problems, I needed to take Viagra. The prescription drug company flat out denied it. They told me I was not a man with erectile dysfunction. I could not take this medication. However, the original reason that Viagra was developed was for people that had the type of heart problem that I had. So I don't know whether Congress has discussed these sorts of instances or not. But for me, it was life or death because I needed to take this medication mm-hmm. in order for me to get a heart transplant, which I now have.
You now have a heart transplant. You've had one.
Yes, I had a heart transplant.
Did you challenge their decision about the Viagra?
I most certainly did. Mm-hmm. I had to fight with the prescription drug company every month to get the prescriptions that I needed so that I could stay alive long enough to get a heart transplant.
Mm. All right. And that, Dolores...
And that was for... 17 months.
Wow! Whoa. I'm glad you're still with us, and it's good to hear your voice. I mean, I knew your father very well. He was my scoutmaster when I was 11 years old in 1957.
Wow!
Yes, he was.
You were a scout?
I was a Boy Scout.
Yes, he was.
Faith Baptist Church.
And
my brother, right? Faith Baptist Church. Ashland Avenue, East Baltimore.
And I still go there.
And you still go there. That's great.
Come by anytime.
I would love to come by. I haven't seen it in years. But what you're talking about, though, is, and Richard, you can join in on this. I mean, come in. But what Dolores is talking about is that this is why people are battling their companies, because of it's all about the bottom line of profit for insurance companies, not about the care of the people on the plan.
Well, there will never be a lack of individual outrages. The question is, if you have the government making these decisions, do you think you won't have these problems anymore?
But, Richard, I don't think anyone is arguing, other than the public option, that the government should make these determinations. The determinations still really do rest with these companies, correct? And most of them have had a hand in writing this legislation anyway, correct?
Well, I
just think it's easy to say that we don't want the government making these decisions, but we do want the government to give us a piece of legislation that lays out who will make these determinations.
Well, you want physicians to make the decisions with the patients about what the patients need or don't need. And if there needs to be a system where there's a red light that goes off.
That's right.
That goes, wait, what is this? But, you know, I mean, if you look now, 29% of the American people are covered by the government. Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration.
And veterans, mm-hmm.
So only almost a third of Americans are already covered by the United States.
By a system that's going broke.
It's going broke because we have no containment costs built into our healthcare system because the overhead and because hospitals are going for profit, they have to make a profit and bottom line. They buy all the expensive machinery because of the profits of the health insurance companies. I mean, there's numerous reasons where money could be saved.
But you know, there is so much that you have to talk about when you talk about who makes decisions. How about the coverage? How about the fact that the counseling is covered throughout this this health care bill? And that's also in the Baucus bill.
Richard, but that's your own.
How about tort reform? How about the fact that
tort reform is a minor part of this, though there should be tort reform.
Well, there's a tremendous debate on how minor a part it is, because I know doctors who say that at each and every step, defensive medicine ratchets up the price of all health care, and it is a tremendous factor in healthcare costs.
I mean, I've been following the research. Lester, go ahead.
I've been following the research on this, and as far as the tort reform stuff, the debate about the issue has been far larger than what the empirical data shows. The empirical data shows that the tort reform is very, very, very minor. If there were indeed tort reform, it would change costs little, if at all.
Although, well, I'd be willing doctors to I know claim journal. That. I'm sorry, I didn't let you finish. Go ahead.
I'd be willing to see another peer-reviewed journal article that says something different, but that's what my research is.
But with respect to defensive medicine, this does not lend itself to empirical measurement. How do you measure when people are doing tests that are unnecessary in practicing defensive medicine?
But
that's not a rhetorical question. Ask the question again.
Well, my question was, how do you measure what is covered in defensive medicine? How do you measure when physicians are doing extra tests that they don't need to do?
I think one way it has been measured, correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, is that in some states that have introduced fairly strong tort reform, they measured how much costs have gone down and how much procedures have gone down, and it hasn't been as large as some might have thought. But I presume this is difficult to measure.
Yeah.
Now, you often hear that 30% of procedures are unnecessary. Partly mm-hmm. for reasons of desired profit, partly for reasons of defensive medicine. The only point I'll make, again, as someone who covers the press corps every day, it's stunning to me how completely – I understand why politicians are in the bag to interests, because interests pay for their reelection campaigns. I don't understand why big newspapers have completely taken a pass on attempting to explain where all this money is going, because there has been no attempt.
We will come back to that in just a minute and more. We have to take a very short break and come right back with all of our guests. We're also going to lurch into some new territory, President Barack Obama and the Nobel Prize controversy is part of what we will tackle when we return as well. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhoff are available at 410-783-8000 or at bsmusic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And before we launch back into our conversation with our guests, I want to remind you something really critical if you want to keep the station on the air alive and growing. The WEAA's Fall Membership Drive is just around the corner. I'm going to give you the opportunity to help us shorten the number of days for our on-air campaign by becoming a WEAA member right now with your pledge of support. For every $25,000 in pledges we receive before October the 17th, we'll cut one day from our on-air campaign and get back to the programming that you love a lot faster. So do your part today and call 443-885-2075 or go online at weaa.org and make your pledge to support this program and the programs you care about on this station. Remember, it's 443-885-2075 or log on to weaa.org and become a member there. And I'm encouraging everybody who has been a supporter of the Mark Steiner Show for the last 16 and a half years to become a member of WEAA right now by calling 443-885-2075. All right. We're back in the studio here with Bob Summerbee, editor of the Daily Howler, and an op-ed contributor to the Baltimore Sun, as is Dr. Richard Vatz. After being put in exile there for so long, he's allowed now to have his professor at Taos University.
I didn't have to sue them to get published. That's the difference.
Editor of Current Psychology. He has all these titles, he likes me to say. An associate psychology editor of USA Today, and he thinks he's a good tennis player as well.
I am.
Wow.
Dr. Lester Spence is, I don't know, Lester, you're not a tennis player, are you?
Can I make 130?
He is professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, and Anthony McCarthy is host of WEAA's Anthony McCarthy Show, is here co-hosting today.
Can I make one 30-second self-indulgent remark?
No.
No.
About your tennis playing?
No.
Good.
The blacklisting at the Sun was the worst thing I've publicly ever gone through. And it's the most unethical thing. And I was just astonished that the Baltimore Sun would do something like that. You know, and the change in personnel, which has now changed that policy, is a very salutary change. But the one thing I want to say is that I talked to people at the Columbia Journalism Review, and they couldn't care less.
30 seconds.
So... And on this program, even though you and I sometimes are on just the opposite ends of the spectrum, I love having you here as a guest because
thank you.
It is important to exchange ideas.
I love being here. Thank you.
410-319-8880. Let's take a little twist here. Let's talk a bit about the controversy surrounding President Barack Obama and the Nobel Peace Prize. What were you going to say, Anthony?
No, I was just pointing to your notes on the...
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Your notes are there, Mark. And because we have a lot to talk about today, and that's part of it. We're going to be talking about the Gay Rights March and more, and Barack Obama, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and a great deal of other things. But this controversy in the prize has caused a lot of discussion in this country and abroad, but especially abroad. It's been very interesting to watch the press debate, and we'll hopefully have folks from worldmeets.us on to talk about the world press. What were all your initial takes on Barack Obama's winning of this prize, Dr. Lester Spence?
I got the call about it like 5 in the morning. I was in Denver, and my first thing was, what the hell did he get it for, right? But when I thought about it, you know, I thought that, I mean, we have to remember that even though he was nominated like just like approximately 15 days after he had taken office, he had already been in office kind of, sort of, since, like, November, right? I mean, I'd never, like, he invented the office of the president-elect. I saw him more in November than I saw Bush. We also have to remember that because of the policies of Bush, the United States had pretty much been rendered almost a pariah on the international scene. So to that extent, Obama was perceived as a breath of fresh air. But the most important thing I thought, once I got over my questioning, was that this represented an excellent opportunity for American citizens in general to think about what peace means and to push him to live up to this, that they think he hadn't quite done enough yet to deserve it.
Richard Vatz, what about you?
Well, that's my opinion, except for the quite. He hadn't quite done enough to deserve it. I mean, I thought that, I wrote a blog on this in which I kind of supported his getting it. Because I felt that intentions and hope are everything, and in fact, one of the points I made in the blog was that President Obama has been hoping for years. I mean, he wrote The Audacity of Hope years ago, and I mean, if hope is the currency that wins you these awards, then I think we should all start hoping. But hoping is a pretty inert activity, and I think doing is a lot more important. And I think that in a more serious sense, that you should win a Nobel Prize for doing, not for hoping. And I think it, to be more serious than my blog was, I think President Obama, nice guy that he is, warm-hearted guy that he is, attractive guy that he is, I think his winning the Nobel Peace Prize was just patently absurd to the point where even his supporters couldn't support it.
Yeah, I think it's personally, I think it's unfortunate for Obama that the Norwegians did this, because it's something he's going to be ridiculed about. And the award is, in my view, sufficiently out of keeping with the normal practice of awards. Now, sometimes the Nobel Peace Prize goes to an established figure who has really done something over a period of time, achieved something or seemed to achieve something. Sometimes it goes to very brave leader, less well-known leaders around the world who put their lives on the line for some very noble cause. No one has ever won the Nobel. No president has ever won the Nobel Prize in his first year. It's his first term, you mean? Yeah, his first year.
Right.
It's an odd. Right. By the normal standards of the prize, it is a sort of an odd selection. And he's going. Unfortunately, he didn't give it to himself, but he is going to be ridiculed for it. Our politics works on ridicule now. It's going to be his version of Al Gore said he invented the internet, which Al Gore didn't say. And I think it's going to be I think it's going to be unfortunate on that basis, and I'm sorry that this is going to happen, but we're going to hear about it forever. It's going to generate 1,000 silly discussions. And, you know, if Obama had given himself the Nobel Peace Prize, then you might want to talk about it. He didn't give himself the Nobel Peace Prize.
Let me challenge just one assumption of what you say. I'm not a supporter of President Obama, but I don't feel any urge to ridicule him.
But many people are going to. Going to go on and on and on forever.
But how about the option to turn it down?
Well, that's a difficult thing to do.
Well,
Lester and then Anthony.
Let me start. So there are a couple of things that I think need to be corrected. One is only 3 sitting presidents, Obama's the 3rd, have actually gotten the award. And the first 2 were like in the beginning of the 20th century, if I recall. So I'm not sure that that's the proper comparison. The second is that Al Gore got the Nobel Peace Prize, and for what I understand, the environment is still jacked, right? So there are a number of people who've gotten the award for events that are ongoing and events that they've tried to stave off. So it's not just a matter of people having had this long history, right? So even though I understand or critique, it's important we actually get it right. I talked to somebody about this on the radio just yesterday, and they couldn't name who received the award last year, yet and still were able to go off for a long tangent on how they think Obama didn't deserve it, right?
What is? I don't understand. What's the point that they couldn't mention about last year, therefore,
there's a racial component that this individual is bringing up specifically, but I'm bringing up that point because there's a whole lot of discussion about this that I think is driven by things other than him receiving the award and other than the history of people having received the award.
And the thing I would add, and I'd be very curious to hear from our listeners about this prize and their thoughts, is that when you actually read, and it was a unanimous decision by the Nobel Committee, which right. oftentimes it is not, and when we were reading the history and doing the research today, this award has been given so many times by split decisions and decisions by the Nobel Committee to recognize multiple winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. But unanimously, they gave this award to Obama, and they said they did it because not only of his work on nuclear disarmament, but his work at bringing a whole new component to the conversation of international diplomacy that his predecessor did not bring. And it's not just the...
That would have been true of any Democratic president. I'm not saying this to criticize mm-hmm. anything Barack Obama has done internationally at all.
Mm-hmm.
But any Democratic president would not have been like George Bush.
Well,
before we turn to William Kern, his review of what the international press is saying, because it's all over the map, I want to read you some of the people who were on the nominee list. All right, it was reported in the Independent from London. And I'd like to get your thoughts, 410-319-8888. Those of you listening right now to the Mark Steiner Show, here with Anthony McCarthy and our guests, to talk about what you think about President Obama being given the Nobel Peace Prize. I really want to hear your thoughts. But these are some of the people who did not get it, who were nominated in this on the ground. One was Dr. Denis Mukwege, who is from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and he has treated tens of thousands of rape victims in the Congo, much in, into his, and brought this state. He's a gynecologist. He's been treating rape wounds. He's treated 21,000 women in those war-torn countries at great risk to his own life. The other person being nominated was Seema Samar, who works with Afghan women and families in and out of the camps and crossing the borders illegally, organizing hospitals in the face of the Taliban trying to kill her. Ghazi bin Mohammed, who is a Jordanian, who has been a philosopher of peace in the Muslim world. Greg Mortensen, who actually I interviewed once, who was a mountain climber who has gone into the Islamic areas to create mountain climbing schools for peace among the Pashtun. Piedad Cordoba, who is fights both the government and the drug lords of Colombia looking for peace in Colombia. Wei Jingsheng, who is the father of Chinese democracy and the democratic movement that led that had stiff jail sentences. He was one of the leaders of the Tiananmen Square movement for democracy in China. Now, I just want to throw that out. These are some of the people that the Independent in London has written about, saying they were the other nominees.
So they fit into the category of lesser-known people, not world statesmen, who have done remarkable work at risk to themselves.
At risk to themselves.
And this is one category of winner. At some years it goes to remarkable people like these. Some years it goes to international statesmen.
Right.
What the professor said reinforces what I said. If only two sitting presidents have ever won the award at all. It's not the norm to give this award to a sitting president, and let alone in his first year. And he's going to be criticized. He didn't give himself the award. He's going to be ridiculed for it. And in part, the ridicule will stand up because it is outside the normal practice of the award. And I think it's unfortunate he's going to be criticized for it. But this is going to be an area of silly commentary
Let me say first of all that not everybody who finds this award inappropriate is going to ridicule Barack Obama.
I understand, but a lot of people are.
And I also think the option that we're not discussing and which you've kind of cavalierly said is absurd, I think there's no reason why he could not have refused this award.
I didn't say it was absurd. I said it's a very difficult thing to do. Okay. They wake you up at 5 in the morning and tell you you won the Nobel Prize. He hadn't even thought about it. It wasn't even on the radar, anyone's radar. So you say, well, I'm sorry, it's 5 a.m. here, but I'm not going to accept this award.
On the way back to the phones, very quickly, last year, then I'm going to open the lines here.
No, I don't have a comment. I'll respond when I hear some of the calls.
But, Mark, I would say this. You read this very emotional list, and it was a list of outstanding human beings who are changing the world. I'd be very curious at who was nominated the year Jimmy Carter was given the award. I would be curious to hear who was nominated, who was also nominated when Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King got the award, and when Al Gore got the award. I think that outstanding, incredible human beings who are changing the world are nominated every year. The Nobel Committee makes these determinations, not all of us sitting here or those who are criticizing or blasting the president right now. I think that to make those determinations or even make those comparisons of whether or not he's done something like help rape victims in the Congo, I think begs the question of the Nobel Committee saw significant reasons why he should be given the award.
But that's not an interpretation, that's a fact.
Let me open the phones here. We have a lot of people calling in. I promise that William Kern, I talked to him earlier, who is the editor of the worldmeets.us, who translates articles from throughout the globe every day, incredible website that shows what the world's thinking about America and our policies from all perspectives, joins us for a few minutes. And then, and that was that you, William Kern, taking off in a spaceship? William, are you there? Good.
Yes. Okay. Yes, Mark. Good to be with you.
Welcome. So we want to open to get some of our callers in here, too, but give us a sense of the spectrum of ideas that you've seen in the press. I noticed it's the most recent thing up there is the French paper, I'll probably butcher this, Donner Nouvelle d'Alsace from France,
saying that
this could cripple the presidency.
Well, on the you guys were just talking about this, and I'll just a short pull quote from that story: Nobel Prize to cripple the young president. The article says, "Getting America to face the crisis that resulted from 8 years of quote unquote Bushism was already a challenge. Doing it with a white flag in one hand and the Star Spangled Banner in the other is a tightrope act that puts him doubly at risk."
That's That's what is your sense of what the opinions are from around the globe? Can you give us this?
Okay, I'll give a quick compendium. There's like 30 stories up there from around the world right now. Certainly encourage people to go and look. So from Italy, there's an article that argues that it wonders whether this is just a slap at Bush or a repudiation of Bush, which we found in our media as well. An article that I found very interesting was from Sweden. We had the Swedish translation. The interesting thing about that is the Swedes hand out all the other Nobel. The only one they don't hand out is the Peace Prize. And actually, nobody knows why Alfred Nobel decided to let the Norwegians hand that one prize out. Mm. In any case, so the Swedes were against it. They thought that they kind of took a slap at the Norwegians, saying that they were carried away with Obama's election. They went too far. They went overboard for Obama. And they have discredited the prize by giving it to him. So I found pretty shocking. The Iranian coverage has been unbelievable. There's an article from Iranian state-controlled newspaper Kayan that basically calls it a conspiracy by the Zionist media, calls him a traitorous, murderous African. Some of the language there is not for children in there. India had an interesting article. I think it was the Hindu or the Hindustan Times. It's in the upper right-hand corner.
I'm looking at it.
Their argument was this was just a way for the Nobel Committee to raise its own profile. The headline is Nobel Committee wins and Obama. You know, that's why they were saying that he did it. There's a lot from the Israelis. One of the articles we have from the Israelis argues that this Nobel will give Obama added legitimacy to confront Iran, which is kind of interesting.
That's interesting.
Let me
just open the phones. There's some folks in this conversation. We can all continue talking with all of our guests and the people who are calling in right now. 410-319-8888 is the number here. A lot of people have called in, so let's get some of these folks on the line. By the way, which is about Nobel, he was probably doing his own peace move because the Swedes and Norwegians hate each other so much that they had to give a little bit to this, a little bit to that to keep everybody happy in the Nordic nations. 410-319-8888. Jay, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I was one of the few ignorant masses who was so very proud of our president receiving the award, because I'm almost disgusted daily of how our country has yet to support our president. You know, I was in the military for 10 years, and regardless of my political beliefs, I supported the will, you know, and the decisions of the president. I was respectful of that office, and I think our president has yet to receive that. But I think he does hold greater influence, and he garners greater respect internationally, and God bless him, because he's inherited the impossible, almost, you know. And I love this country, and our president has inherited the impossible. What if he, taking a breath, is going to be criticized, you know. So I was so happy that day that I woke up, I heard something positive about my president. And I think every day, every step he takes is a step towards peace. His international relations and the diplomacies that he's exhibited is a step towards peace for this country, for my friends who are still fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and to make this country much better than what he inherited. And I stand by and support him and thank God for the Norwegians.
Jay, thank you so much for your comments and thoughts. I think one of the arguments that people can make, though, is that one of the reasons the Norwegians gave him this award is because of the potential he's given the world. Because as many Europeans believe, and this is a European-based award, that President Barack Obama gives them a great deal of hope for where the world's going to go under this new leadership in America. That's part of what this is, which is also, it could be very tough on Obama.
Let me just say a couple things, if I may. First of all, If you were bothered by the disrespect given Barack Obama, you must have been in apoplexy over the disrespect given by George W. Bush, because there's no comparison.
But let there me certainly just, isn't.
There isn't. Let me,
not in the first year, Richard. Trust me, he was not getting a lot of disrespect in the first year.
And let me say something
else.
He
had to earn it.
Let me say something else. All right, let me. I think this proves my point. Let me say something else, I've said this before, and I've said this in my blogs. I've said this virtually every time I've been on the air about the president. I think President Barack Obama is one of the brightest, classiest human beings that I've ever seen in the presidency. I think he's a good family man. I think he's very articulate. I really personally like him. His sense of humor is more like my sense of humor than George Bush's was like my sense of humor. But I don't think that his actions as president to a conservative are very impressive. And I have every right to say that, and I'm not going to hold back on that, and that's what I think.
That's why you're here. 410-319-8888. Pam, you're on the air.
I'll hold back on that.
Pam?
I recognize that voice.
Pam, you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to say, and I had called in early, but I'm riding home, and I'm listening to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm calling again. And I just wanted to, I had a quick comment as far as the president winning that Nobel Prize. I'm with the other lady. I think it was an honor for him to win, and I'm really saddened and disappointed on how much cruelty he has been receiving, because the Norwegians, gave him that award. I think it's wrong. I'm with her. I think we have disrespecting the president. By the way, Bush did not get it in his first year, and as that guy said, he earned that.
Okay.
And I really don't think that Mr. President Obama has earned it.
Pam, thank you so much. Let's try to get another call in here. James, you're on the air. James, you there?
You hear me?
Yeah, but, yep. Go ahead. Yeah,
I just say, it's a bunch of educated people always on there talking about various issues. It seems to me that Obama didn't win 100% of the vote. And whatever that percentage, whether it was 40, 30, 38, or 50, you're going to always have them talking in a negative terms in that. So I think we already got enough of that, as we're only 13% of the population. Should always try to pick the out about it. Because like Donald Trump said, he said, there's a lot of guys on television that's talking about real estate. Said, but they're not selling real estate. They're selling books. I have developed property, and I sell real estate. So I can't. To me, I'm so proud to 74 have him there. I'm so proud at 74 that he survived 9 months. I'm so proud that around the world he has opened dialogue where Bush didn't want to come in. I'm so proud that when I wore that uniform back in the, I wouldn't wear that uniform nowhere now because it's a target. But I do believe with his opening dialogue around the world and talking like a human being and like other people have things to talk about, too, you might be able to wear that uniform again without being as terrified as people are now.
Well, I think that's, again, one of the arguments people make in supporting this is that what it portends for the world, how the world views us and how the world views Obama's administration and what he may be able to do. That's the hope factor infected in many ways Europeans much more deeply maybe than even Americans. Very quickly, Richard, I want to go back to William Kerr.
We don't have to talk in broad metaphors. I'll ask you one question. Will Iran have nuclear weapons in the next couple of years? If they do not, and if they will not, then I think Barack Obama has a major victory. If they do, then I think he has a major shortcoming.
I'm not sure.
Let's say something, Mark.
Got William Kern, go ahead, very quickly.
I think Americans don't understand or they don't realize the incredible relief that is felt around the world because we have a president that is approachable. We have a president who people feel is reaching out to some of the other players out there, who's not just shutting the door on all these other players. And to them, that is huge. It's a sea change in international relations.
It's much, much bigger from abroad than it is looking at it from the United States.
Yes. We have to take a very short break. We're going to come back in just a minute. I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite explains a new movement in architecture and design, debates the downsizing of Baltimore City, and offers an in-depth look behind the state's biggest transportation project. It's the Building Issue, available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com. for a list of drop locations. We'll be right back with a bunch of some of the same guests and some new guests, so stay with us. We'll be right back.